Tamla Nicole Wells went missing a week after police were called to her home because of a domestic dispute with her boyfriend. The car she was driving was later found by the same boyfriend, who destroyed any potential evidence in the car. Is he responsible for her disappearance? And later, we discuss the case of Adele Wells, who disappeared under suspicious circumstances in 1958. Adele would be 66 today. Did someone take her and raise her as their own, or was she met with foul play? What if your loved one went missing? What if years and years went by and you couldn't find them?
Tamla Wells just one day disappeared. Nobody knows where she is.
How much would you give to get them back?
She gathered with community activists and family members today to help keep hope alive.
What if no one cared?
We should cover the country we have and not the country that we apparently imagine.
This is Lee.
And this is Travis. Good evening. Welcome to the fourth episode of the Missing Minority Project. Please rate and review us on whatever platform you're listening to and share us with your friends. These cases need ears, so we appreciate your help. Big shout out to the True Crime Story Time podcast. If you haven't given them a listen, we recommend that you do. Head on over to truecrimestorytime.podbean.com and check Casey and Samantha out. The cases they cover are told exceptionally well, and we think you will enjoy them. As a warning, our episodes contain adult content and listener discretion is advised.
This episode is a little different from our others. I reached out to Tamla Wells' mother, Donna, through Facebook after I saw a post after Tamla's disappearance. Donna gave me a lot of information about her struggle as the parent of a missing person, and we're going to discuss what it's like to advocate for a missing person when it seems like no one is listening. This case needs a lot of ears and eyes, so please share Tamla's story and also give a listen to the already gone episode about this case. Tamla Nicole Wells, or Nikki as she liked to be called, and how we will refer to her, disappeared on August 6, 2012, from the 197,000 block of Appleton in Detroit, Michigan. Nikki was 33 years old when she disappeared. She was 5'5" and weighed 160 pounds at the time of her disappearance. She is African American, has black hair and brown eyes. She has a scar under her chin and the scar on the left side of her forehead. She has two ear piercings in each earlobe and was wearing a white cuff shirt, denim shorts, and earrings when she disappeared. Detroit is an important backdrop in Nikki's story, so I want to talk about it for a moment. She disappeared while the city was still reeling from the Great Recession, when former Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick was being investigated and then was later incarcerated for racketeering, fraud, and extortion. This was all happening when Detroit saw a 36% poverty rate, a 27% vacancy rate, and had one of the highest homicide rates since 1991. In 2013, just 11 months after Nikki disappeared, Detroit filed for the biggest municipal bankruptcy in the United States history. And so it's in this city, then rife with economic turmoil, that Nikki disappeared. A city where a missing person was just a blip on an already crisis-filled radar. Nikki is the second oldest of her mother's six children. She was born in Detroit in 1978. At just 15, Nikki met a married man named Ricky Tennant, who was in his 30s at the time they met. According to Donna, Nikki snuck around with Ricky, and by the time she was 18, she and Ricky were seeing each other. Ricky has a criminal record, and at that point had served 2.5 years in prison for breaking and entering. Despite this backdrop, Nikki had managed to get her GED and finished nursing school, and by the time Nikki was 26, she and Ricky, who never married, had a daughter.
Even from the outside, Nikki and Ricky's relationship seemed troubled. Ricky reported that Nikki changed after the birth of their daughter, saying, and I quote, "She was a good-hearted girl, but after the baby, she had changed and she was a different lady." He said, "I could tell you so much stuff, it's ridiculous. And you will say, wow, you put up with all of that? She used to use the baby against me to do the things she wanted to do. But me and Tamla, we might have argued and everything, but we loved each other. Real, real, real bad.
However, Donna and Nikki's friends have differing views of why the relationship soured. According to Nikki's friends, she would come stay at their houses after fights with Ricky so that Ricky could cool off. Sometimes the fights turned physical. Those same friends reported that Ricky would come to get Nikki a day or two later, apologetic and promising to change his ways. And Nikki would usually return with him until the next time. On August 4th, 2012, a week before Nikki disappeared, Nikki and Ricky fought so loudly that the police were called. Donna said that Nikki was planning on leaving the relationship before she disappeared because she no longer felt safe. Donna and Nikki took to planning Nikki's exit from the relationship and from Detroit before her disappearance. Nikki's nursing skills landed her new opportunities near Donna, and Donna was scheduled to go to Detroit at the end of August to pick up both Nikki and her granddaughter so that they could start anew, away from Detroit. However, that never happened. On August 6, 2012, Donna spoke with Nikki around 9 p.m. Donna could tell something was bothering Nikki, but Nikki assured her she was fine and that they would talk later. They never did. Donna's phone rang at 6 a.m. the following morning, but it wasn't Nikki. Nikki's six-year-old daughter was on the other end of the call, reporting that her mother hadn't come home after leaving the night before. Donna called her daughter repeatedly on August 7th, 2012, with no response, which was unusual since Nikki reportedly kept her cell phone on her and charged at all times. Nikki was reported missing to the police late in the day on August 7th, 2012, and by August 8th, 2012, Nikki's phone rang straight through to voicemail. Donna couldn't reach Ricky on August 7th or for a full 6 days after Nikki's disappearance, and the only correspondence that Donna had about Nikki's disappearance was with her granddaughter. Donna wasn't deterred by Ricky's silence, however. She started calling Nikki's friends, the ones who'd known Nikki well, and none of them knew where Nikki was, and Ricky hadn't come looking for her like he typically did after their fights. Suspicious, Donna arrived in Detroit as quickly as she could after Nikki disappeared and found her daughter's home in disarray, which was not characteristic of her daughter. Every light bulb was missing, clothes were rambled through, and all of the blinds and curtains were closed. By the time Donna arrived in Detroit, the story of Nikki's disappearance started to emerge in the media. According to Ricky, Nikki was acting strangely the day he last saw her and told him that she was going to pay him back for something. Ricky said that he didn't pay any attention to her comments or to her behavior, and he instead opted to pick up his daughter, who was playing down the street from the house. The last time Ricky said he saw Nikki was when he was on his way back from picking up their daughter down the street. He said he saw Nikki riding by him in his white Pontiac Grand Prix, a car that Donna said Nikki rarely, if ever, drove because she had her own, newer car. Ricky told the media that Nikki told him she was going somewhere, but wouldn't tell him where, although he said that sometimes Nikki enjoyed going to see friends in the old neighborhood, and he thought that that's what she'd done that evening. At some point during Ricky's account of Nikki's disappearance, Donna had her last phone call with her daughter around 9 p.m.,
Days passed with no sign of Nikki until Ricky claimed he heard from a friend named Bud, who apparently spotted the Grand Prix abandoned 10 miles from Nikki's home. Before alerting police, Ricky went to the location of the car on the east side of Detroit and searched the car. Ricky noted that the only thing he noticed missing was a basketball and a jack from the trunk, and then he drove it home. Ricky told the media that a witness who lived across the street from where the car was parked saw a tall, skinny black man park the car and walk away. According to some early news stories, some of Nikki's clothes were in the car. However, in 2016, police indicated that whatever potential evidence may have been in the car was compromised during Ricky's search of the vehicle.
Despite Ricky's unseemly involvement with the car search, police were quoted in 2013 as saying that Ricky cooperated with the investigation and that he was not considered a suspect. But by 2016, their tone had changed drastically. Although the police haven't released many details of the investigation, Sergeant Ball from the Detroit Police Department said in an interview with Crime Watch that Ricky was or is a suspect. Quote, "Everything leads us back to Mr. Tennant in some kind of way. That's not something that normally happens, but in this case it is." Police said that Ricky failed more than one polygraph and that he became so agitated during the interview that they were afraid he was going to attack the examiner. and, quote, "that is not the behavior of someone who is innocent," end quote. The police further detailed that Nikki's daughter was aloof and hesitant during her interview with the police, and that they were concerned about her exposure to Ricky immediately preceding her interview. Police said that just because they may have suspicions about Ricky doesn't mean they can close the case. They need to be able to prove those suspicions beyond a reasonable doubt.
For his part, Ricky has always denied any involvement in Nikki's disappearance, and he hasn't been shy about voicing his thoughts on both Nikki and their daughter, saying that his daughter gives him a headache and that Nikki used to give him a headache as well. But, and I quote, "I deal with it, and I'm looking at it right now as one headache is better than two." He later denied that those statements were related to what happened to Nikki. As for the polygraphs, Ricky said that he took only one polygraph and that he failed it either because he was using marijuana at the time or because he was angry about all the things he allegedly was hearing Nikki had done. Ricky said that her disappearance bothered him for about 6 months, but he had moved on with his life.
Donna doesn't have that luxury. When she arrived in Detroit in August 2012, her first thoughts were to find her daughter. One officer early on told her that her daughter was probably dead in the river somewhere. She managed her grief and her heartache while going door to door, making phone calls, and searched vacant houses, garbage dumps, and morgues. Detroit is a huge city, and Donna is just one woman. She once said of her efforts, and I quote, "The neighborhoods are so run down. The grass is taller than me, and there is trash and garbage and abandoned houses. I feel like I'm lost when I'm there. Where the hell do I look for my child in all of this mess? She could be anywhere." Donna has learned what no parent wants to learn, that there is no handbook for the parents of the missing. She's on a first-name basis with a nameless employee handling her daughter's file. She's emptied her wallets on posters and billboards and websites, only to learn that what she needed was even more reward money. She has none of Nikki's property, as Ricky delightedly told reporters a few holiday seasons ago that he wasn't going to give her any of it. And there's just nothing she can do about any of that. Donna quietly travels back to Detroit even now and searches for her daughter. She's learned to accept the help she can get without stepping on toes, all the while pushing for more and more information. She's had her hopes dashed so many times. Insofar as what Donna thinks happened to Nikki, she tries not to point fingers because she doesn't know for sure what happened, but she shares many of the same suspicions that the police share. But she also holds on to hope that maybe Nikki was scared off and that one day she'll find her alive and safe. So with Nikki's case, I think I agree with the police about what happened.
Yeah, definitely. Ricky looks pretty guilty here between the polygraphs as well as their previous domestic situation. So looks bad on you, Ricky.
You know, I was doing some research when we were looking into this case. Domestic violence, the statistics alone, since they had the previous altercations, according to the CDC, 55% of murdered women in the United States are murdered as a result of domestic violence. So, I mean, statistics alone kind of indicate that it was Ricky. And I hear the patterns of domestic violence woven into the story and have no doubt that it was occurring in the household. And I'm pretty sure, you know, if Ricky found out that she was leaving, that was the catalyst for her disappearance.
And his response in the public afterwards, they're kind of, I don't know, the best word I can think of is aloof. He seems emotionless, like he doesn't care, almost like he's relieved of the stress of the relationship with Nikki, as well as with his daughter. So for me, like I said, Ricky looks really guilty.
It starts for me when the accounts of Nikki driving the white Grand Prix, which according to Donna, according to friends, according to everyone else, she doesn't drive this car. So Ricky's last sighting of her is in this car that she never drives. Why is she in that car? I think he said she's in that car because he wanted that car to go missing so that he could have her car, the newer car. That's my opinion. So he put her in that car so that when that car went missing, he could have her car and that car could be totaled out or listed as stolen.
I definitely agree there. I mean, the car situation doesn't stand out as much to me. It's just kind of one of the pieces to a much larger puzzle, but I agree what you're saying.
And then he doesn't show up, you know, to look for her after he typically does when they have fights. That's a big red flag. we have all these reports that after they fight, she goes, she leaves the house, she goes to stay with friends. He comes looking for her. He never does that this time. So in my opinion, he knew that she wasn't coming back.
Most of us are creatures of habit. So if that was their routine for the fight, this is definitely a red flag.
I think a lot of the problem here is, though, that he seems to have destroyed all the evidence in the car, because he goes and he looks through the car. He destroys all the potential evidence in the car. So if there was any forensic evidence, it seems like in that 2016 interview with police, they're saying it's gone.
I think that, yes, him going into the car definitely interfered. But let's say if there's a large amount of blood or something, as far as DNA-wise, either the police didn't do a very good job of searching the car after the fact, or he did one hell of a job of a cleanup.
His behavior after the fact is pretty bizarre. He fails the two lie detector tests. He ignores the police request not to influence his daughter for her lie detector test. He won't give Nikki's mom anything. He says he moves on after 6 months. All of that, to me, in total, is suspicious. But the lie detector tests, for me, are less of an issue. I know that even the American Psychological Association doesn't agree that they're valid. So that doesn't necessarily upset me as much as maybe the rest of his behavior.
Yeah, the lie detector results, if I'm not mistaken, I don't think they're admissible in a lot of states anyways. There's a bunch of factors that could have caused him to fail them. But like I said, just him overall, he just looks guilty.
Something that's really interesting to me, and I don't have the answer to, is what about potential phone pings here? I know we were pinging phones when Adnan went to trial back in 1999. For those of you who listened to Serial and Undisclosed, there was much made about the phone pings in Adnan's case. Here we are in 2012, and Donna is calling Nikki for a good 24 hours before her phone rings to voicemail the day after she disappeared. What happened with the phone pings? Do we have pings? Did they take the phone records?
Yeah, that baffles me as well. I'm not exactly sure about the science behind it and all that, but it looks like the police kind of drug their foot initially. And I think initially they thought it was a domestic situation that she's running away from. So, and maybe I'm completely off base, maybe whoever was taking the lead on the investigation almost felt bad for her because of the previous domestic situations. So maybe they were kind of giving her a head start, for lack of better words. They weren't trying to find her.
That might be true. So we've certainly seen before where that happens, where they're thinking something different may have happened, that maybe she left the domestic situation, maybe she left her life, which I don't think is the case here at all, and they weren't pressing very hard. But another thing that's bothersome here is the car. If you assume that Nikki was actually in the car or somehow was transported in that car, it's found 10 miles from her home. So if we assume that Ricky is involved, there has to be another person involved. Otherwise, how did the car get to the other side of town? And then Ricky got back home. There had to have been another person that took Ricky from the site of the car back home, don't you think?
Oh, I agree. But only thing I can think of, if Ricky put the car there previously and then drove himself in a different vehicle to the location. But I agree with you 100% that the car being out there, either someone helped him or he planned this way in advance.
I guess he could have followed her over there, potentially in her vehicle, but that makes no sense because she doesn't typically drive his vehicle. And then for him to get in her vehicle and follow her to the other side of town, that doesn't make for a good scenario to me. I guess there's potential that Nikki did, in fact, take his car to the other side of the town and was met with foul play somehow that way. But again, you have to assume that she drove that Grand Prix, and I don't think that she did. She had her own car. Everyone says she was never in that car, so I just don't believe that that was the case. I stand by my theory that he said that he saw her in that car because he didn't care if that car was stolen or something happened to it on the other side of town once he did dump it, and then he resumed driving her car. As I mentioned in the opening, there's a huge vacancy rate in Detroit, so I think that unfortunately, disposing of a body wouldn't be very difficult. The vacancy rate's about 30% there. I wonder how much police have searched all the vacant properties in that area for Nikki.
I'm hoping, and I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt, that they've done the best they can to find her. But I mean, with the crime rate, as well as other things going on in the city, I'm sure they didn't spend a lot of resources or a lot of time looking for this one woman.
I hope going forward that the police are committed to finding her. They use some language in their last interview in 2016 where they throw in, we need to be able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Ricky actually committed the crime. That leads me to believe that they may be working up to, you know, getting a case with a district attorney and having him prosecuted. And I certainly hope that's the case, because I do not believe for one second that Nikki walked away from her life. There is no indication that that happened. She, I believe, would have been in contact. She was in contact with her mother every single day. She had a child. She was a good mother. I do not believe that she walked away from her life. I believe that we are absolutely talking about foul play. I don't even think that there's a reason for us to discuss the potential of suicide here, because again, we have no evidence that that would have happened. We would have found the body and all of the other factors that usually go into a case like this where suicide just doesn't seem to be the answer here. I think that we're talking about a case where the police are correct and they need to push forward and find justice for Nikki. The only reason that this case has had the coverage that it's had is because of Nikki's mom, Donna. There is no way that this case would have had any coverage, I believe, if it weren't for Donna pressing forward, giving interviews, constantly engaging the media. And in that regard, it's so frustrating because here we have this domestic violence case, and I believe it's a open and shut domestic violence case, which deserves attention for so many reasons. And without Donna calling people and making sure people don't forget her daughter, I believe that there would have been even less coverage than there was, than we found. And there wasn't a lot here. Nikki's favorite season has just passed. Thanksgiving, Christmas, her birthday. So we'd like to ask listeners to honor her favorite season with some action. We need you to do a few things. First, please share her story with your friends, families, and followers. Second, please go follow the Help Find Tamala Nikki Wells page on Facebook. Donna updates regularly, and there are links to her other websites on there. Donna needs to increase the reward money in Nikki's case, and from my understanding, she's working on setting that up. But for now, she has t-shirts for sale. The most important thing, though, is to please contact your elected officials and the police department and encourage them to push forward with Nikki's case.
Anyone with information is asked to contact the Detroit Police Department at 313-596-5844. That's 313-596-5844. Tips can also be submitted online at blackandmissinginc.com. That's blackandmissinginc.com.
Nikki is loved by her family. She's a wonderful daughter and a perfect mom. She's caring and giving and loved to make people feel important. She loves her nieces and nephews, and she was always very invested in her siblings' success. She checked their report cards and always supported their decisions. Let's bring her home. Have a listen to a new true crime podcast teaser before we bring you the Adele Wells case.
Hey everyone, I'm Jamie, and I host a podcast called Murderish, which takes you inside stories of murder and other creepy events. The first episode of Murderish lets listeners be a fly on the wall for a first-degree murder trial. The story is told from a juror's perspective, as I was that juror. If you are a true crime junkie and need to know every detail, you'll feel right at home with this podcast. Follow Murderish on Twitter at MurderishPod and on Facebook at Murderish Podcast. And don't worry, this doesn't mean you're a murderer. It just means you're murder-ish.
The next case we're going to cover is the mysterious disappearance of Adele Wells in 1958 in Flint, Michigan. Adele and Nikki are not related, nor are their cases. Adele's case popped up next to Nikki's when we were searching, and we decided to cover her case too. This is a case you are unlikely to have heard about. We went through lots of archives to bring you a timeline about her disappearance.
Adele Wells was 7 when she disappeared from 929 East Marengo in Flint, Michigan on November 21st, 1958. She was 3.5 feet tall and about 50 pounds at the time of her disappearance. She's African American with black hair and brown eyes. Adele had her hair styled in waves at the sides with bangs. She was last seen wearing a gray cotton coat, a blue dress with small animal figurines along the lower hemlines, red knee socks, and black shoes.
Adele was one of seven children. She had three brothers and three sisters when she disappeared. She's also reported as one of nine children, both back then and now. She's the daughter of the late Martha and Carl Wells, who was a factory worker.
In 1958, Adele Wells was a second grader at Jefferson Elementary School, which is now known as Second Chance Baptist Church of Flint. Remember that Michigan would have been like at this time. This was 4 years after the landmark decision of Brown versus Board of Education, which made segregation of schools illegal. However, it is likely that Adele's school and neighborhood were still mostly segregated. So on November 21st of that year, Adele stayed home from school because she had a cold. At 11:30 a.m., Adele decided that she was going to go to school after all. She said goodbye to her mother and headed out into the chilly November air. On her way to school, Adele stopped by her grandmother's house, which was approximately 2.5 blocks from school. And that was the last time there was a confirmed sighting of Adele.
Adele's mother didn't report her missing because she thought she was at school for the day. However, around 5:30 p.m., she suspected something was amiss and called the police to report Adele missing.
By November 23rd, area newspapers were covering Adele's stories and the flurry of activities surrounding her disappearance. On that same day, police set up a temporary search headquarters inside the city limits. Police conducted searches in a wooded area that separated the school from a graveyard, and members of the community showed up to assist in the search for Adele. In fact, more than 1,000 people showed, including 90 policemen, veterans of foreign wars, Flint and suburban firemen, the Civil Air Patrol, auxiliary police, and Boy Scouts searched 9 square miles of Flint. They searched the banks of the Flint River, reservoirs, a cemetery, a golf course, and many open fields. According to the papers, they searched inch by inch of that 9 square miles and didn't find a single trace of Adele. One evening, police got a lead from a schoolmate and 4 neighbor girls who said they saw Adele being forced into a car by a man or 2 men in a pink and white car with large white fins. Police said the witness accounts were vague and conflicting and later discredited the accounts of the pink and white car.
By the next day, November 24th, the police expect the worst, stating, "She's been gone for more than 3 days, and after that much time, we're pretty sure it's something worse than a runaway." And all search efforts for Adele were called off.
Police got information from reliable citizens who saw a small girl being carried by a young man to a dirty black Chevrolet. The car was between 8 and 10 years old and was last seen on Lewis Street by a creek in the area. The man was described as young, light-skinned, and African-American, and he was wearing a gray coat with red socks. Children at Jefferson Elementary School reported that the same car had been seen in the area in the days leading up to Adele's disappearance, and then that man tried to lure them into the car. By November 25th, just 4 days after her disappearance, the police were at a dead end, and the media coverage drops off by November 26th of 1958, and that's possibly because Thanksgiving was the next day, on November 27th. In 2014, law enforcement contacted the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, or NCMEC, for assistance in solving Adele's case. The center takes on cases in which the subjects were minors at the time of their disappearance, which is why it still searches for adults like Adele. NCMEC released an age-progressed photo of Adele, who would be 66 years old today, and is one of the oldest missing persons in the NCMEC database. Her family has always held out hope that she was taken by someone and raised as their own child.
As usual, Adele didn't get the attention that she should have gotten. Only one time during the time that this was going on after she disappeared was her disappearance printed on page 1. Mostly it was buried from page 3 or to page 10. So when we were back in the archives looking at her case, we had to look buried in, you know, pages 3, 4, 5, 6 about this little girl that's missing. It was really sad.
And to add on to that, after 1958, we didn't hear anything until 2014.
Yeah, it was very disturbing. I would have liked to see at least the yearly revisits of the missing person, you know, the updates where the case is gone, and I found none of that. Very sad. What do you think about the thousands of people, I'm sorry, not the thousands of people, but the thousand people that showed up to search for her? In terms of cases that we see in modern day cases, that would be a huge number. What do you make of that?
I think it just shows that when someone goes missing, especially a child, people are willing to help in any way they can. And if there's any silver lining in this, it kind of just shows that there's still humanity out there.
As much as I am impressed by the turnout that day, I am unfortunately scared as well, because they searched, the thousand people searched 9 square miles and found no trace of her. So that leads me to believe that she was abducted from the scene pretty quickly.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you take a 7-year-old and throw him in a car real fast, there's not going to be much evidence left behind. So them not finding anything isn't very surprising to me.
I'm of the opinion here that she was likely abducted by the man that the students reported seeing in the weeks leading up to school. And the reason I say that is because she kind of went at 11:30, which is an off time to go to school. She wasn't going to school at a time that someone would be there waiting for her. So I feel like it was someone that had been there that was just kind of lingering outside the premises of the school who would be there at that weird time at 11:30 when she walked to the school. And that man being there in the weeks leading up to her disappearance kind of fits within that profile.
I think whoever did it definitely staked out the area. Like you said, being around a school 11:30 is not very common because it's an odd hour. But either she made a contact with this person prior and they arranged this meeting, or he was just lurking and he was just an opportunist. And unfortunately, he ran into her and snatched her.
I think that that's the most likely conclusion I can reach from the information that we have. Unfortunately, there wasn't coverage that would lead us to believe that the police interviewed friends and family who would be the more likely suspects in a child abduction, at least from the statistics we're familiar with today. So I can't reach that conclusion. So if the witness sightings of that man were true, I believe that that's likely what happened to her. The family always hoped that Adele was taken by someone and raised as their own. I guess that could have happened, but I would like to think at some point in Adele's life, there would have been something to tip her off, at least by now, that she wasn't who her abductor said she was.
At 7 years old, I think you're well enough aware of who you are and where you're from. So someone abducting her and trying to raise her as their own, that one doesn't sit well with me either, because I just think that if someone questioned that person about a 7-year-old child who just popped up in their life, you can't rehearse that. Like, she would know that they're not her parent and so on and so forth. I think this is the family holding on to hope. I guess I can understand, you know, you never want to believe that your child is dead.
I definitely think it's a situation where Adele was taken by an adult somewhere else. Don't think that she ran away. There was no history of it. And you have that really intensive search with 1,000 people over 9 square miles. I'm pretty sure she would have been recovered in that case. I hope that they find her someday and the family, at least who is left in the family, gets some peace with Adele's story.
Here's what we need you to do. Go to the site for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and take a look at Adele's age progress photo and see if she resembles anyone you know. For our listeners who lived in Flint, Michigan around the time of her disappearance, or who have family members in the area, please think back. Was there an uncle or family member who drove a black Chevrolet? If you have any information, call the Flint Police Department at 810-237-6800. 810-237-6800.
Adele was described as a punctual and dutiful girl. We talked about domestic violence today and how dangerous it is. If you are a victim of domestic violence and need help, please call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-7233.